a wonderful day.
Members of the committee will come to order. We are at quorum, and Representative Kath, I'm wondering if you would move the minutes of our last meeting, which was Thursday, January 8th. Those are in your packets, members.
So moved.
Representative Kath moves the minutes of January 8th. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. Members, there's an agenda in your packet. I'd ask you to refer to that. We basically have a four-part agenda, this is meant to be the first of several meetings early in the session where we hope to do, hope to provide ourselves some good background information of some of the more salient, broad public policy issues that currently face us and that have generated a lot of energy both in the K-12 community and here in the legislature. Some of the upcoming sessions, and I'll try to get you all a schedule as soon as possible about this, will most likely include a full discussion about mandates in K-12 and the relation, particularly the policy implication of mandates. We know that our finance committee will most likely be wrestling with mandates issues, primarily as it relates to fiscal implications for K-12 school districts. But of course, as you all know, those mandates emanate from public policy considerations and goals. We're also going to spend some time, a session perhaps, a full session, talking about educational race disparities in K-12 education, what's commonly referred to as the achievement gap. A number of you members raised that issue, identified that issue as an important issue in your district, and so we hope to hear from local experts and communities of color in regards to this issue. I'm also, I haven't quite filled this out, and would definitely ask for advice and assistance and participation in shaping up a discussion around teacher professional development issues. That's a big waterfront of issues, and so I'm kind of wrestling with how to properly structure a good, you know, background introductory, you know, orientation, you know, a good awareness session on that, and would look for your advice in that. I do want to also ask most of our, many of our major educational professional organizations and educator groups to do brief presentations to us in terms of what they're thinking are the most salient, important public policy K-12 issues that that they're wrestling with and that they would encourage us to consider as well. I'm sure I am missing, we're also going to do a good full session just sort of walking through the 101, if you will, of our state's K-12 accountability framework, our assessments, be able to do some, you know, very, you know, you know, broad differentiation and discussion among ourselves about different approaches to assessment, to assessing our schools and assessing our students, I think that's it on that. Seemed to me there was one other session that I want to do, but I can't quite think of it right now. So today, what we're going to do is hear from several of your colleagues who have been involved in some important K-12 policy issues during the interim. As many of you know, and as many of you will learn, the notion that Minnesota has a part-time legislature is a quaint, nice idea, but it is that. It is quaint. Most of you will find yourselves very busy, if nothing else, doing very important constituent work throughout the course of the year. But many of you will most likely, and based on what I heard from many of the presentations and the interest and the passion and the intellect gathered here around the table, most of you will most likely be involved during the interim in some pretty important public policy vetting and exploration with the public and among yourselves. I have in the past commissioned, if you will, subcommittees, task forces of this committee to work on some important issues when we're not in session. At times, we'll have public hearings with all the weight of a public hearing in terms of participation with the public. And then we also spend quite a bit of time interacting in small groups or as individuals with people in the field of K-12 education and meeting amongst ourselves and our staff to fully understand some of the emerging research and evaluation of public policy work in K-12. So we've had a couple of those groups that have been working throughout the interim. We're going to hear from some of your colleagues who've been involved in those. We'll be hearing from Representative Abler about our charter schools working group. Both the House and the Senate authorized, our committees authorized a task force or committee working group to explore the legislative auditor's recommendations that came out, I think it was during the middle of our last session, on charter schools. Then we're also going to hear from Representative Dietrich, who has been involved in the RAD high stakes issue. I think Representative Loon, you referenced in your comments something to this effect concerned of the what the implications are of the high stakes grad. It's my opinion that the implications are potentially quite big and negative, and so it's really important, I think, for this legislature and the executive branch to figure out a good way to remedy that particular potential negative outcome. There's been some very good meetings with legislators and with the executive branch, highly collaborative, and so we're going to hear a little bit about that. Then we'll hear from Representative Brainerd, who was a point person 2 years ago on a working group dealing with the school report card, which developed multiple measures, framework, and suggestions for a school report card. Perhaps the more salient feature of that was the suggestion of using a growth model. That was a highly visible and at times highly contentious issue. Good ideas often are contentious, and that's okay. It did lead to a veto of our omnibus policy bill, but nonetheless, in the interim, both the executive branch and our working group members have arrived at, I think, a pretty good place in terms of moving forward with the growth model. We're going to hear from the department about that growth model that they are now implementing, and Representative Brainerd will talk about that as well, and then also, I suspect, talk about multiple measures, work that continues to need to be developed in terms of assessing the effectiveness of our schools. Finally, we're going to hear from the commissioner at the end of our toward the end of our meeting in terms of her advice and her thoughts of broad policy areas that the department is particularly interested in and that they would encourage us as a legislature to address. So with that, members, we're going to start with our always ready and able and capable Representative Abler. And Representative Abler, you can either come forward or
I'll go school from here.
Stay where you're at.
Don't mind.
Right. Thank you, Jim.
Keeps it shorter that way, probably, too. And I'll try to be brief, but I'll try to get the highlights. Charter schools are fascinating. For those who don't know, I founded one in 1994, the PAC school. And I rent to one now, just so you know. So I'm disclosing that. They gave us a summary of lease aid, and my rent for them, the one I rent to is $6 some per square foot. So, it was nice to be in the bottom of the pack. So, charter schools are public schools, as you all know, and they were designed to give some chances to innovate and experiment on programmatic areas and reach out and try to achieve some goals, and then before you ruin the whole state, you try to this little experiment. And there have been some very successful ones and some miserable failures, which you would expect in the bell curve. And in the working group, Representative Slocum was the House lead, and then Representative Norton was there, and Erdahl, and I forget who else, but I'm forgetting some people.
Representative Simon.
Oh, and Simon. Yeah. And so, and the Senate had quite a little larger contingent. We had some meetings together, and now they've moved off into separate tracks. If you want to read the auditor's report, which is fascinating reading. Anyway, if you didn't get one, there's copies at the end of the table, so Paige could bring them to you.
Why don't we have the pages pass those out?
Yeah.
Thank you, Emily.
Yeah, some might have them, some might not. But just to keep it short, I'll summarize the things that are moving ahead that people seem to agree on, and then I'll just give out little areas of where the controversy is. There's some issues about sponsors. What's the sponsor supposed to do? What's their duty? How much do we pay them? Where does the money come from to pay them? Do they have authority or not? Is it just a good name on the line? Can they weigh in? Can they have a membership on the board? Can a church sponsor? How about a religious organization? Those are issues that are yet unresolved, even how to say it. There's been some controversy about one in particular, which you read in the paper, about having to do with religious customs and so on. So there'll be some work on that. There'll be a bill coming forward, and it sounds like there'll be a House bill and a Senate bill, and they'll have to. There was some thought to pre-collaborate, but as it goes along, then there'll be a dialogue and a conference committee about that at some point. But there are some areas where there's great agreement about some of the accountability matters, conflicts of interest. They have to disclose that. Some of them are pretty closely held, and it's in 1994 I went to a National Charter School Conference. They talked about building an airplane while you fly it. That's how we felt back then. 15 years later, I think we're beyond that, and I think that the expectations we ought to have, personally as a founder, as a involved with the movement since the second year of its existence, is that we should expect that they should export good ideas and not to squish them with accountability so they can't think anymore, but to be, and as we layer on some rules, to be careful we don't take away their freedom to think and to innovate, but to expect that they're going to be producing an outcome for some of the, especially at-risk populations. Some of the non-disadvantaged populations aren't too hard to succeed with, and there are some are focused on the mid-range. The challenge is how to teach the top, some of the high-end potential students. And there was some controversy about some are racially segregated, so it is said. Don Samuels came and some other gentlemen who were involved. And they don't quite agree that just because a school is largely one racial group or another, but that's necessarily segregation. If you go there by choice, that's different than being forced to drive past three schools that you can't go to, which we had a very pointed meeting about that with Mr. Orfield came. And in fact, some of those schools have extremely high outcomes. In one case, I think 98% are college ready and bound, which I'm not sure any school that does that beyond that one. So it's fascinating, and there's the room for growth and for injecting new ideas into our system is profound. And let's see, the school board members, there's an issue about teacher majority or not, and there's some ideas that are drifting around about that. Part of the problem with the teacher majority is that if a majority of teachers are running the board, they are hired by the person who they hire to run the school, and so who's really in charge, and are they free to express themselves freely? And the answer, I think, is no. How do you handle that is a question that you'll be asked to talk about later, part of the bill coming forward. Let's see. The contractors are discussing about having a length of contract that's longer. And probably the more controversial one, which isn't really germane, the department's coming out with some kind of a bill, which they didn't disclose what that might include. One of the more contentious ones that was yesterday at the meeting, which is not really a policy matter, although there is some policy questions which we want to wrestle with, has to do with lease aid. And not so much the lease aid for buildings that are just being schools just renting a building, but about this ownership question. And it's been an issue since the very beginning. Are charters stable enough to own a building? And if they are, how much building and who gets to oversee it? The department had some pointed questions yesterday about lease aid and building corporations. 27 of the 143 charters have a building corporation, which is pretty much an alter ego of many of the same members that are on the board that actually contract to build a building. And the main difference in the oversight of that is there's no review and comment by the department. That's is that good or bad? The department didn't seem to mention that they were concerned or not concerned about that, but that's the big gap. If you think View and Comet is good, if your district might be left alone, that's actually good for the charter school, but they have to meet the fire codes and safety and the ADA stuff. The buildings, what I've given you was just passed out by the department. This is a summary of lease aid paid to different buildings. And the last page is some buildings. There's some data comparing building corporation charters with non-building corporation charters. They tend to be twice as large and have twice as many square feet and as the non-building ones, which is figure your own connection there. There's no data on why they're larger, and you can ask about that. So there's the department wasn't clear if they're going to come forward with something about that. An unanswered question about a building corporation charter is that when the building pays off the bonds in 15 or 30 years, can they still get lease aid? And the answer today is yes, which is an interesting question. They did not feel that they had the authority to not to pay. The final thing I'll mention, then I'll divert to Representative Norton or whoever else wants to comment, was that we have been told over the years that the lease aid contract is sort of a backstop determining quality and the right pricing. And pretty much that's not exactly true. It's a very, very low backstop. And as long as you meet the fire codes, the ADA, the Class B building codes for education, then you're good to go. And having done this myself a couple times, that means that if you had a school, a building that was a school, you converted to a charter school, and it was built in 1840, that still would, with a few exceptions, doesn't have to be brought to standard. A new building has to meet some more stringent criteria. That's also true of any traditional public school as well, that they can, in these old buildings, can go forward under the building code that was in effect at the earlier time. So it's fascinating, and if you're, to me, the charter, as opposed to being a direct competitor, I think it provides it's a laboratory, and I hope that as we urge them to export their findings, that we'll be able to derive ways to solve some of the achievement gap issues, which are so much on our mind, and how do you handle high stakes tests? Maybe they could experiment with that themselves. So that's my report.
Wonderful. Thank you, Representative Abler. And like you, I would join in the hope that this public education, K-12 education delivery sector system that was added to our overall system back in 1994. I think it was earlier. I think the legislation might have been an 89 legislation. And I know when I was first elected in 1990, I took a vote right away on whether or not we would keep that or not. And by a slim margin, we did. And one of the expectations of many of us at that time was that, in fact, the sector would be a good place in which innovation innovation, new ideas, new practices could be developed, but more than that, that there would be a healthy relationship with our regular traditional public school delivery system, so that those would be lessons that can flow back and forth. And I have to say I'm frankly a little disappointed, perhaps more than a little disappointed, that over the years that has proven not to be the case necessarily. And so I think that possibility and that promise continues to be there for us. As many members know, we were the first nation, or the first state in the nation to pass, conceptualize and pass the charter school legislation, and the first charter school was actually authorized in the nation, in our state, in St. Paul, on the east side. There are, I would encourage members to review the auditor's report. We will most likely have a bill that will encapsulate a good a chunk of those recommendations. As Representative Abler shared, apparently the department may also be coming forward with a bill that perhaps includes a major portion of the auditor's recommendations. This issue of lease aid, I don't think, was addressed in the auditor's report, I'll stand corrected if I'm wrong about that, but nonetheless, seems to be an issue that has some legs. The Senate certainly moving ahead, I think pretty strongly, with attempting to address some aspects of this issue. Representative Riley, I suspect a good chunk of that is going to land in your committee, particularly given some of the fiscal ramifications of going in and attempting to do something different with lease aid. As many of you know, there may be some other issues, some that have surfaced in the past. There's been some concern with schools that have affiliation with religious organizations. That's certainly gotten some visibility over the last year or two. There are, I think, increasing concerns about, in an age where we have diminishing student enrollments in virtually every school district, there's a great concern of what happens when school districts, you know, attempt to downsize the delivery system by closing schools, may then face interest on the local community to form a charter school in the very same geographic area that the district, you know, just decided they may need to close the school. And so there's some big policy ramifications here in terms of good stewardship of public resources in that regard. So I suspect there'll be some, we know there's some resolutions from some of our professional education groups in this regard. And then finally, the issue that you surfaced, Representative Abler, the integration issue, I think is developing sort of more passion. We do have a number of charter schools that are very specific about tailoring their outreach and their delivery mechanisms to very distinct racial ethnic groups. Many, of course, which are not currently in mass anyway, in the macro level, faring well in our in our regular public school system. So there's some really strong passions on both sides of that issue, and I suspect there'll be some recommendations coming forward on that as well. Thank you for your work. Thank you, Representative Norton, for participating in the lease aid discussion. And members, Representative Slocum, I'm told, who I've asked to be the point person for this, came down with pneumonia about a week ago. And so she's fairly okay, but let's keep her in our prayers and thoughts. It's always tough to get pneumonia at any time, but it's tough to do it in session. So look forward to interacting with her when she comes back on this issue. Members, we're going to move on. I promise I will attempt to open up some of this discussion for give and take, but I do want to make sure that we keep moving. We did start late here this morning. Is Representative Dietrich?
Yeah.
Representative Dietrich, we're going to talk a little bit about the grad test, and I believe Dr. Mastin from the department is also going to join us for that discussion. So, good morning, Representative Dietrich. Good morning, Dr. Mastin. Why don't you come on down, and then our own Lisa Larson from Health Research will also be a part of this discussion. Representative Dietrich, I leave us in your hands to choreograph this discussion as you think fit.
Good. Thank you and good morning, Representative Slavik. I will just note that I beat you here this morning.
Well, I'm
proud. Don't notice. We do have a competition going here.
What's the score? 1-1?
Is that
okay. Very good.
Healthy competition. I think it'll improve us both, our on-time rate. Good morning. We are going to approach this grad discussion in three different parts. The first part, we are going to give a little bit of a historical context as to standards accountability in the state of Minnesota. And Lisa Larson, our House Research Person for Education Policy, is going to run us through that historical context. And then we are going to get real specific and talk about the grad test in and of itself. And Mr. Dirks from the Dirk Mastin, from the Department of Education is going to talk about the technical aspects of the test and how it works and how it's administered, and then I am going to, and I think that you will see that there are some issues then at hand, and I am going to talk about those issues that have arisen last legislative session, and how we have proceeded on those issues since then. So I will call on Lisa Larson to go ahead and get us started from a historical context.
Yes, Larson.
Good morning, members. Representative Dietrich advised yesterday that I do this presentation in the form of a story. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that that made a lot of sense. What I've been asked to talk about are two tests. First, the basic skills test, which we had for about a decade, and then the grad test, which is part of the MCA too. Of course, the expert on testing is to my left, but I thought...
Somewhere in that end of the room.
But I thought it might help to understand some of the history. There is a timeline and there is a sequence, but to say that it's linear is probably misleading. So what I'd like to do is talk about both the basic skills tests, which are minimum competency tests in reading, math, and writing that were first administered to eighth grade students in the 1995-96 school year and became effective the following year, and then to talk about the standards-based, and the acronym is GRAD, but in case you're curious, it stands, the name is Graduation Required Assessment for Diploma, which is how it came to be called, GRAD test in reading, math, and writing that are became applicable to public school students who entered the eighth grade beginning in the 05-06 school year. I'd like to go back a little. In the 1980s, a number of reports, including A Nation at Risk, came out to suggest that education was in a bad way. We had a State Department of Education at that time, and they were very sensitive to this foment. And about 1990, they decided to do in the Carnegie Unit. The Carnegie units were the way in which we measured students' performance in school at that time. Carnegie units were pejoratively referred to as seat time. So the board disbanded with the Carnegie units, and the question became, well, what next? The first proposal that was put forth was something called outcome-based education. And I recall seeing a piece of paper put out by the Department of Education at that time that had lists of all the proposed outcomes, and they were many. Well, that proposal didn't last very long, and it ultimately led to the development of the profile of learning. But the profile was all about performing certain kinds of tasks, and it was in the framework of no longer focusing on input, but instead focusing on output. The concern at that time was that if we are going to have a results-oriented education process, we needed to be sure that there was some kind of measure for the floor for student performance, and that's what the basic skills test became. They were minimum competency tests to ensure that there was a floor of educational understanding or performance. So students were first required to take the minimum competency reading and math basic skills test in the 1996-97 school year and the writing basic skills test in the 1997-98 school year. The last students who must pass these BSTs to graduate from high school entered eighth grade in the 2004-2005 school year. The BSTs required students to demonstrate basic knowledge and skills in reading, math, and writing. The math test required students to understand math through pre-algebra. And you may remember that now statutorily we are requiring not only Algebra 1 but ultimately Algebra 2 for kids. The reading test required students to be able to read at a difficulty equal to popular adult nonfiction. And the writing test required students to respond to an adult reader by writing a composition in response to a request for information. Students needed a 75% passing score to graduate from high school. Since 2000, the department has reported BSP results using a scale score, and 600 is the passing score for that purpose. Students who did not pass a BSP, and remember they started taking the BSPs in reading and math in eighth grade, could retake the test twice each year and three times during their senior year. limited English proficiency students who had been in an English-speaking school for fewer than 3 consecutive school years had a temporary exemption from the BSC for up to 3 years. And students with disabilities were eligible for test accommodations or modifications consistent with their IEP. Now, toward the end of the 1990s and into the beginning of the 2000 decade, many, many things were happening. The legislature repealed the State Board of Education. The legislature repealed the profile of learning. There was a great hue and cry for accountability, generally. The Elementary and Secondary Education Act was reauthorized in the form of NCLB. And remember, NCLB required an alignment between state standards and state assessments, and the state adopted new K-12 academic standards. All of this occurred within the context of about 5 years, between the end of the 1990s and beginning in 2000. But once the legislature adopted the new academic standards, a number of initiatives followed. For example, in 2005, the legislature required students enrolled in grade 8 in the 2005 and 2006 school year to take the MCA2s. And I mention the MCA2s because they are, I think of them as the umbrella under which the grad test, the grad portion of the grad test exists. And so that's their significance in this context. The 2006 legislature required the Education Commissioner to revise and align the state's academic standards with the graduation requirements. Specifically, the law directed the Commissioner to revise the state's math standards in the 2006 and 2007 school year to become effective in 2010-2011, and also to require students to complete Algebra 1 by the end of 8th grade and Algebra 2 by graduation. The 2007 legislature established state graduation test requirements for reading, math, and writing. And there are two possibilities in statute about students taking state reading and math tests. They can achieve a level of proficiency on the MCA2s, or they can receive a passing score on the grad test. And that is established in statute. It's stated better than I've just stated it, but that's the requirement. Also in 2007, the legislature gave the Education Commissioner specific authority to adopt rules to implement and administer the grad test, consistent with the statutory parameters for that test. Under Minnesota's Administrative Procedures Act, because more than 25 people raised questions about the proposed grad test rules, an ALJ, an administrative law judge, presided over a formal hearing and prepared a report on the proposed grad test rules. The ALJ's report, among other things, said that the legislature's delegation of rulemaking authority to the commissioner provided sufficient authority for the commissioner to adopt grad test rules. Now to the grad test requirements. Based on these laws and rules pertaining to testing, public school students who enter the 8th grade as of the 2005-2006 school year and later must pass the standards-based grad test in reading, math, and writing in order to graduate from high school. These are different from the basic skills test. The basic skills test were minimum competency tests. These tests are standards-based tests and consequently have and were intended to have a more rigorous expectation with respect to performance. Ninth grade students were required to pass the writing grad test beginning in the 2006-2007 school year. 10th grade students were required to pass the reading grad test beginning in the 2007-2008 school year. And 11th grade students must pass the math grad test beginning this school year, the 2008-2009 school year. What some people characterize as high-stakes tests measure student proficiency against Minnesota's K-12 academic standards. The tests are meant to reflect increased academic rigor based on established criteria that are not generally affected by the performance of other students. These are based on criteria rather than normed against performance of other students. For example, the ACT and the SAT are norm-based tests, but these tests were, at least to some great degree, intended to be criteria-based. Students meet grad test requirements in one of four ways. They receive a proficient score on the MCA-2. They receive a passing score on the grad portion of the MCA-2. They receive a pass individual notation if they are an eligible student with a disability. Or they receive a passing score on a grad retest. Students who do not pass the reading or math grad test can take a computerized grad retest at various times during the school year after receiving remediation. The department, I think, and Dr. Matson can confirm this or correct me, the department anticipates a four-year exemption for ELL students. Students with disabilities may be eligible for accommodations or modifications consistent with their IEP. And finally, the math grad test passing score, which is a subject of some debate that you may have heard about recently. Under state statutes currently, the education commissioner is directed to determine the passing scores for the grad test using something called standard setting process. This is a method for establishing cut scores that correspond to student performance levels. According to the department, at least in the ALJ report, a realistic passing score represents a balance between requiring students to demonstrate sufficient knowledge of content and providing that an appropriate percentage of students pass the test. And that's a little bit different than just straight out criteria-based tests. So that's part of the dilemma here. During the 2007-2008 school year, a large number of juniors in Minnesota public high schools did not pass a math test similar to the grad math test. The department, and again, Dr. Matson can update or correct me if need be, wants to use actual student performance data from the initial 2008-2009 math grad test to set the cut scores. Some school officials argue that setting the math cut scores so that 11th grade students will know the level of competency they need to demonstrate math proficiency only after the initial grad test is administered in the spring of 2009 will put many of the class of 2010 in jeopardy of not graduating. And that's the background to a lot of this discussion.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Very well done, very concise. Would it be possible to share those results with committee members? There's a lot there. And I, you know, I've been around for a while, and I'm always, you know, playing catch up and remembering certain things. Well, I found your presentation to be very helpful, since it's pulling together a bunch of very complicated developments in this area. If you can do that, it'd be wonderful. Thank you. Representative Easter.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Right now, what we'd like to do is call on Dr. Matson and ask him to talk about some of the technical pieces of the test and how it's administered.
And before you do that, Dr. Matson, I'm just noting the time, but I don't want to rush you. I really don't, because I think it's really important that we get a good, solid ground here of understanding. We'll obviously be revisiting this issue much more in depth because most likely a bill will be coming forward, perhaps more than one bill in regards to the grad test. But I just want to kind of alert Representative Briner that in terms of managing the time, I may just jump after this to the department and then perhaps have you, as your committee member, be part of the Thursday discussion. And actually, your presentation is very much in line with what we hope to do on Thursday. So I just want to give you a heads up. Thank you. Dr. Matthews.
Mr. Chair, members, and thank you for that reminder, and I'll try and be very conscious of the time and yet be as thorough as I can. The good news is, I a couple pieces of good news, I have four slides, and Ms. Larson has covered all of number one here already for me. So I'll try and reference the items that she asked for, or follow up, or maybe elaborate on a few of them. She gave you this background already, that the test now, the basic skills test has been sunsetted, and we're now looking at three different competency tests, writing in ninth grade, reading in 10th, and 11th grade mathematics. And certainly 11th grade mathematics is the one that's received plenty of conversation. So in the interest of time, I'm going to move past this slide. She went through the administration schedule, passing scores and so on, and the mathematics score has yet to be determined at this time, and I'll speak more about that on the last slide, if I may. Again, I feel I may revisit some of the things that Ms. Larson did so very well to explain. The set of tests that we are talking about here is aligned to the 2003 set of standards. So the standards that were implemented under then Commissioner Sherry Pearson Yeki, those standards are the tests, those are the standards to which these tests are aligned. The tests themselves, the design of them, are they multiple choice? How many questions do they have? How many questions on particular content or concept was designed in 2006 with the assistance of state educators? And so those educators came together in the committee, as we do when we begin any test development process, and they helped design what should that test look like. There was much conversation from stakeholders at the time in the 2005-2006 school year, and there were two concerns that were brought forth at that time. One was to reduce the amount of testing time, and something that certainly the department is very conscious of with the number of tests that are required for students. So a design that was taken on was to embed this within the administration of the high school exams. Otherwise, if you think of it under BST concepts, we would have to do MCA, Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments, for state and federal accountability, and then there would be another graduation test that would have to take place for another student sitting of an assessment. So we tried to combine those administration times, and at least in the design intended for that, we were successful at that. Another concern for both, it really should be the 10th and the 11th grade exams, is that because these MCAs are accountability tests and schools and districts are judged according to student performance on those tests, there was concern, especially with the mathematics test, that there was less than 100% motivation by students to perform on those tests. There were no student stakes on those tests. When we administered those tests in the first year or two, and still up until this time, roughly about 25% of the responses where students explain their answer are left blank. That's over about 2.5 to 3 times more than any other grade. And so that's either, one, they don't know the content on that, or more likely what we are sensing based on the performance on the rest of the test, was that the motivation may not have been as high. So a second design principle that was implemented was that it would be, we would combine it so that the accountability tests would also have motivation for students. Even though the BST was a minimum competency exam, these two are designed to be minimum competency exams. Now, the minimum competency, definitely, because the standards have changed, has ratcheted up considerably. So because the standards have become more rigorous, the exams in accord have become more rigorous as well. The 11th grade test that is a mathematics is noted here, but also 10th grade reading we're talking about. It's important to remember, too, and Ms. Larson mentioned the recent revision, and I think we're scheduled to come back to you on Thursday and talk about this, the recent revision of the mathematics standards in 2007. That is not the standards to which these assessments are measuring. We're preparing for that transition to a new set of standards, and what does the next assessment program look like designed to be aligned to those, but that's not the test. So these tests do not include, for example, Algebra 2 items on them. These are not the students that were required to have 8th grade Algebra 1 and Algebra 2 by the end of their high school career. The test specifications that designed this test are publicly available, unlike, I guess, as I understand from my colleagues in neighboring states or other states in the union. Minnesota posted test specifications and describes exactly what is contained on that test, the content, the number of items, etc. And each year we're required by testing standards to produce technical reports, and this is for those that are really want to get in the weeds of how each item performed and how test curves looked and distributions and all those fun statistics. We post technical reports each year that we produce exams, and that's true for the grad as well. On the graduation required assessment for diploma, I'm going to take you through these more than three boxes, but a couple of points here. There's three portions of the test, essentially, and so I'll try very carefully to do that. In the spring, when students either in 10th grade or 11th grade, reading and math respectively, sit down to take their MCA2 test, they're actually taking two tests at one time. The student is not aware of which items are counting for which, and that's purposeful. Otherwise, there would be differing motivation according to as they approach one particular item. So at first, they're going to take a rather lengthy test, and I'll explain why it's lengthy, and it's even longer than we have an extra 20 questions on there, and I'll explain what those are for. If students are not successful on this test, as was mentioned, they can retest on a computer-based system where we've produced equivalent test forms of equivalent rigor for only the 40 questions that are going to count for the graduation test. So very quickly, I'm going to try and start in the center of this chart and then move out. On the top row, it says the MCA 2 is scored on based on 50 total items. So essentially, we've got 25 items there that you see in the second row that are called common items. Those items are going to work for two tests. They're common among both tests. That's the name. And so they count both for the student's accountability test, their state and federal NCLB test, the MCA2s, and they also count toward their graduation test. To the right of that are the MCA2 only items, those 25 that only appear on the MCA2. Those count toward accountability, but do not count toward the graduation test. And again, this is all seamless to the student. The test looks like any other test that you had, the rest of our tests, 3 through 8. To the far left on that row is the essential items. And these are items that are based on Minnesota academic standards, but are not necessarily high school level standards. To describe the content for both reading and mathematics, most commonly these would be 8th grade level standards from our current Minnesota standards. They only count toward graduation. You can think of them as essential learning. Here's 25 from high school in the common item, but there's another 15 that Minnesota teachers went through and said, okay, here's some other benchmarks that we really feel students should master. In some cases, for example, in reading, it might be just additional vocabulary items or additional main idea or comprehension, some very seminal concepts that are covered in that content. On the far right are field test items, and we do this in every test. Minnesota employs a strategy called embedded field testing, and that means there are questions that are in the exam, and this is common not just in Minnesota, but every test, whether it's norm referenced or what have you, they field test questions. And essentially that is trying out the question, it's not testing the student. And so what we're doing is gathering data on that question. Did the question perform as we expected it to perform? Did it provide the right kind of statistical measures, etc.? There are 20 of those, and that's a rather robust number, but because we're allowing students to retest every 8 weeks, we need a bundle of those questions to be able to build these other tests that are administered throughout the year. So those, again, are not counted towards student scores, but are necessary for us to continue the program. Then finally, on the bottom row far left, that grad score is only, that grad component there is only the 40 items that you see there, 15 essential items and 25 of those common items. They're all multiple choice questions. They are not, of course, the exact same questions that come from the main administration, but they are equivalent in their construction. Finally, the passing score, and this does become a challenge, certainly both for the department and for, understandably, for districts. In large-scale assessment, commonly, and I know many of you are teachers or former board members, and I myself, we often would sit down and say, well, here's going to be the passing score, folks. When you take your test tomorrow, it's going to be 90, 80, 70, 60. That's going to be the scores, and I'll publish that, and you'll get that in your, we'll put it in the grade book, and eventually your score will come out. That method is a little too arbitrary for a large-scale assessment that needs to have, essentially, each item is reviewed for its complexity and its difficulty, and then there is more of a comprehensive decision made about where should students wind up or what kind of knowledge do we expect. Out of all the 40 questions, what kind of knowledge do we expect? Of course, we want them to get all 40 right, but that's not going to happen. How much is good enough, essentially, is the question that you're answering during standard setting. It's called standard setting because you're setting a performance standard. What's the standard for? We've set the academic standards. This is what we want students to know. And now on those standards, how much is good enough? How much of their performance is good enough to deem them proficient, or whatever term you label? So what happens in standard setting, and again, I'm describing a process that's used across the country in all large-scale assessment programs. We set up an agenda of bringing stakeholders together. We bring essentially two committees together, one of experts in the field, so that would be in the high school math test, for example. We bring high school math teachers, and we have a pool of over 3,000 that have signed up on our website to be a part of helping us build these tests. We set up an agenda, and we review this with national technical experts. The department has, as every state has, a group of national testing experts that review procedures for administering large-scale tests, just as the United States Department of Education just established a technical advisory committee. And they review the agenda and say, yes, what you're doing is consistent with industry standard, and we approve or we recommend these changes. We look at data after students take it under motivated conditions. We have been embedding this test since 2006, and we have data on the questions we want to use, but students have yet to take it under motivated conditions, and this is the essential nut that is challenging to crack. Because it's so late in the high school exam, high school career, we need that motivated data to make an appropriate decision during the standard setting process, and yet that decision is going to come for a high school student very late in their academic career, and we're very cognizant of that. So they take that test under motivated conditions, and again, this is common for setting the standard prior to motivated conditions is possible, but it's always fraught with a bit of peril. If you pick the wrong number, if you say, I think they should know 39 out of the 40 questions, and only 2% of the students were to get that correct, now you have another issue. So it's giving full disclosure, getting all the information at that standard setting process. We bring that group of educator experts together to review the content material and the data. They look at each question and how students performed on each question, and they make essentially a determination of how much of this content is appropriate to say that this student mastered the standards expected of high school students. We also have this standard setting workshop or activity observed by a member of our technical advisory committee to make sure that we follow the procedure they approved and said would be appropriate. We then bring in a second group who are policymakers, representatives from education organizations, legislators, superintendents, principals, and they look at the data based on how many students, if the education experts say this is where the cut scores could be, we run the numbers and say, and this is how many students would pass. And then we have essentially kind of a marriage between the content and the policy. We say, here's where the educator said the cut score should be, and the policy folks look at that and say, can you live with where students would perform on that, where we would have for a passing mark? And again, this happens with motivated data, and that's the delay. Those two groups of stakeholders, as best they can come to consensus, recommend a cut score to the Commissioner of Education. We have yet a third meeting with our national technical experts who also avail themselves to the commissioner, and some legislators have been on this meeting that we had for reading, and talk about, did we follow the process? Was there anything askew in the process that is going to provide you, commissioner, an incorrect recommendation? And they will give their assessment of whether the process was followed. And finally then, the commissioner uses her administrative authority to make a decision on setting that cut score based on those recommendations. Again, the challenge for this is it's always under motivated data. If you do this in eighth grade, you have 4 years to get that information out. When we do this at the end of 11th grade, obviously it's certainly a much greater challenge. And so with that, I'll stop and pause for questions or along.
Let me just make a brief detour. Kathy Wagner is stepping out with Tom Boltman. I want the members just to know who you are. Tom Boltman is with assessment and testing at the Department of Education, and Kathy has just stepped out. She's there she is. Okay. Oh, was that Michelle who stepped out? Okay. Kathy is with is the IT director at the Department of Education. We had hoped to be able to have you part of Representative Briner's presentation, but it looks like we're probably going to push that off to Thursday. I just want to thank you for coming, but I also want to make sure particularly new members know who you are. These are great public servants, very knowledgeable. Please avail yourselves of their services. Well, thank you for being here. Appreciate it. Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I want to thank both of the presenters here today. You did an excellent job of framing the issue for us.
Indeed.
Yeah, and the obvious question then becomes, what next? Well, policymakers, administrators, teachers, students, parents all have a very high level of concern about the students, the 11th graders taking the test this spring. And for two basic reasons that were already outlined is that last year, 2008, only 34% of the 11th graders passed or were proficient on the math MCA2s. Now the question that begs the question of, now since there is the high stakes implementation of it, will that increase the passing, the number of students passing? Second concern is 1 year or probably even a little less enough time to do the appropriate interventions, remediation, to make sure that all students are successful on the test. Because of these concerns, the Senate, Representative Slocum actually had a bill that addressed this last legislative session, so she was just a little bit out on ahead of the curve in her level of concern. And we've all voted on that that provision last legislative session, but unfortunately, it didn't. I think it probably wasn't introduced early enough, and we didn't have enough discussion on it to get something that everybody could get behind. But anyhow, so as a result, what happened is we had a Senate hearing between the House and the Senate over the interim, and what we did was we heard lots of testimony, and as a result of all the stakeholders' testimony, there was generated a list like this. And this was this had all the long-term, short-term suggestions, solutions to this this new test that we are the grad test that we'll be administering this year. And at that Senate meeting, Senator Wieger actually declared that we were going to have a working group, and that Representative Mariani and he would appoint people to this working group, and we were to work with the commissioner until as quickly as we could until we got to this legislative session and then and beyond. And so we have met twice on December 10th and December 22nd. There were people from the School Board Association there, the superintendents, the business community, and representatives and senators at this working group. Alongside us, who has been there is a group called Achieve, and that's the group that Dr. Matson talked about earlier. We have received a technical assistance grant from them, and they have been providing professional expertise and advice to this group. Now, as far as short-term solutions, where we have come, one suggestion is, and I just have to emphasize that no decisions have been made yet, but one suggestion that we have kind of sifted through is that the commissioner would administratively set the cut score at partially meets proficiency instead of proficient. And then what she would ask is that we pass legislation that would include requirements for those students who do not score at the partially meets level, that they would be required to participate in some the interventions or remediation, that they would be required to have two retests of the grad, and if they still do not pass the grad piece of the test, that then they would need to meet all the other state and local graduation requirements and credits and attendance standards for the state. There would be exemptions for ELL and special education students under the current grad rule. But that is not the end of it. As I mentioned before, this is not the final solution. With this work group is going to meet one more time on January 20th. And once again, we are going to be looking at what we have sifted through a lot of the different options, and this is the one that at least seems to have the most support. So we welcome input if people have it. I don't think at this meeting here today we're going to be taking it, but if you have input that you want to give to the stakeholders that are meeting in this group, in the work group, we're more than happy to listen. And I think that there are a couple of bills that are going to be introduced, and I think that that also provides another time to talk about this. But obviously, the school districts are very anxious to have some sort of resolution as to how we are going to proceed with this high stakes test.
Thank you, Representative Dietrich. Members, the work group members, Representative Dietrich, Representative Slocum, and Representative Demmer, so please interact with them for more information, certainly with me and my staff here. I see the commissioner came in. I know her doors are always open as well for legislators to interact with. Members, this is a really important issue, and I suspect that we're going to be having much more in-depth early discussions about this in the session as opposed to later in session. I don't want to be Chicken Little here, but you know, the worst case scenario, we heard some of the possibilities right now in terms of where our current class of juniors are relative to the math test in terms of their past performance, and even looking at the previous, you know, their upperclassmen in terms of performances relative to the MCA 2s. And you know, I'm a little concerned, members. When I disaggregate the information out, in some communities of color, we're talking 80% of that class potentially at this point not arriving at proficiency or even grad. I know that cut score can be set at many different levels, but what would be a quote-unquote reasonable level to set that at, in my mind, tells me that, quite frankly, a vast majority of certain subgroups are simply not going to get a diploma, even though they've gone through our entire K-12 system and have participated in all the other necessary things that they should be doing. But there are other issues here as well. I think you know, this issue will, you know, have some short-term type of immediate concerns, but it also sets up some longer-term discussions relative to our philosophy around high-stakes tests, our understanding of systems accountability versus individual students' assessments, and perhaps also looking at some alternatives. As we interacted with the group of the chief, they put on the table some other possibilities for us to look at as a dominant frame to be able to assess differently. And so I think there's both a short-term and long-term agenda here for us to work on. We're going to need some of our best minds here and good energy, and so I fully invite all members to participate. We will have much longer, obviously, public hearings once those bills come forward, and I hope that you know, that the spirit of collaboration between the House and the Senate and the legislature and the executive branch continues in the positive spirit that so far that we've seen. So, Dr. Matson, thank you. Ms. Larson, Representative Dietrich. The commissioner is here, so Representative Reiner and I am going to jump over, but we will certainly come back on Thursday. Members, we're going to adjourn promptly at 10 a.m. There is a number of meetings that some of us need to be at 10. So we probably will not have, you know, a chance to have a full discussion, give and take, with the commissioner. But trust me, this won't be the last time she'll be here, and we'll have an opportunity to have, you know, a good give and take with the commissioner and committee members. So, commissioner, as always, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Just want to greet everyone and welcome back to the legislature. I hope that you had a restful summer, although it was busy for you all. Campaigning, but it's good to be back and to see all of your faces and new faces and familiar ones. So we are looking forward to a really very difficult session, but we are, as Representative Mariani said, wanting to try to at least provide some solutions and talk about some ways that we can maybe change what we're doing as far as assessment and accountability in a more practical and common sense way, and I really appreciated the working group. And as Representative Dietrich explained kind of our short-term solution, and then moving into, well, what should be our long-term solution also, and looking at putting aside No Child Left Behind, how could we really measure the progress of our kids over time in a more common sense way? So we're exploring, as Representative Mariani said, we have the good fortune of, and Mike Cohen from Achieve, who is the executive director, will be in. He has worked with our state and many states on assessment and advice. He'll be in on, I think, the 27th and 28th of January. We'll be speaking, I think, to the committee, and we're working out kind of the details with that. But he was a former policy advisor to the Clinton administration, and so I'm sure he's kind of going to be deep into the new administration and working with them and with the Achieve organization. So, but they have provided us with a lot of really strong support over the last few years, and we're glad that he'll be in to kind of talk about what's going to be on the national stage and kind of give us a little insight into maybe what will be happening. We just, Representative Mariani wanted me to kind of go over real quickly kind of some of the things that we've been focused on over the last 4 years or 6 years at the Department of Administration. And so we will do that. We, of course, have always bragged about our nation-leading state, and we want to go from nation-leading to world competing because we know our kids need to compete in the global marketplace. So one of the things that we have focused on is looking at the what we need to be doing for our students, and we focused on rigor and college and career readiness. That's been kind of a theme that all of us have had really legislatively and administratively over the last few years. Whoops, I'm sorry. There we go. Sorry. Just to give you a little lay of the land, in 1950, 80% of the jobs were classified as unskilled, and now an estimated 85% of all of our jobs are classified as skilled, and so you can see the dramatic change in what is facing our students over time. We know that in 2010, there will be jobs that don't even exist today, that we can't even anticipate. We also know that today's learner will have 10 to 14 jobs by the time they are age 38. That blows my mind away. But yet I do know lots of young people who have already embarked on at least 3 or 4 different career changes since by that time. And then also economic forecasts demonstrate that between 20 to a third of our jobs will need to have some kind of scientific or technological information or background to be able to get those jobs. We've been, as I said, focused on initiatives to increase the rigor in college readiness. And as you all know, we have changed our standards, particularly in math. We have Algebra 1 now required in 8th grade, Algebra 2 to graduate from high school. We still have the 3 years of math required. As I understand it, the University of Minnesota is actually considering requiring 4 years of math. I think they'll be making an announcement about that fairly soon. We also are in the process of revising our science standards. We've been working with the P16 partnership. We have a couple of work groups that are actually helping the higher ed expertise that is working with us on the new science revisions, which will now include a new strand of engineering all the way through K through 12, which is really exciting. Massachusetts is the only other state in the nation that has developed that, and we're looking a lot at Massachusetts' model to incorporate that, but we really think that that is cutting edge and what our kids should be learning, as well as all of our other science exposure. We require now, starting in, I think it's 2011 or 13, I always forget which year it is, our students will take, we have the requirement now of 3 years of science, but it's just biology that must be taken, and by that, in another 4 or so years, students will be required to not only take biology, but a choice of either chemistry or physics to graduate. We also have done a number of other things that we think are very important. We have launched a Mandarin Chinese initiative, and over 3,000 of our Minnesota students are learning Mandarin Chinese. That's double what it was just 3 years ago. We have an agreement with the Hanban in China. They will be providing 50 Chinese teachers to come to the United States each year. That will help us with the transition as we train our own to become Mandarin Chinese teachers, but this will be a wonderful, exciting opportunity. We also be expecting that we'll be sending teachers from Minnesota to China to also participate in their educational system. We also, as a part of our Get Ready, Get Credit, if you remember that legislation, we put a lot of money into advanced placement, international baccalaureate, and college and the schools programs. You can see the what has happened with the advanced placement. We've had an increase every year for the last 3 years, and at the same time, we've had an increase in the number of students that are taking advanced placement. Our test scores have stayed very high. We have just as many students that are scoring at a 3 or above, which then allows them to get dual credit. Also, our IB programs have grown dramatically. In fact, the IB organization is probably going to be coming in soon and maybe using Minnesota as a training center for our IB teachers. We're hoping that happens. We now have a diploma program in 13 schools. We have a middle years program in 8 schools and a primary years program in 6 schools. We have nearly 30 other schools that are in the application process, and we have, I think, at least 2 school districts that are completely IB schools now. In our college and schools program, we had 42,000 course completions. 28 post-secondary institutions collaborated with 270 school districts. We had 6,000 courses that were taken by juniors and about 11,000 were taken by seniors. We had 73 courses that were taken by males, 10,000 were taken by females. And because this is such a popular program, the program was capped at $2.5 million, and so we did have a proration amount of money that went to the schools to support it, but it was exciting to see the growth in both the AP, the IB, and the college and the schools program, because all of those offer dual credit for students. So that they can kind of start off their college years with a little savings and money, but also a leg up on the rigor and the expectations of what college should really be. We also have focused on teacher effectiveness and teacher training and teacher support. We really know that, as Robert Marzano said, that teachers are one of the most key to student success, and having those really good teachers is important. We also know that about 50% of our or 30% of our new hires leave in 5 years, and that is something that's not acceptable. We want to figure out how we can support these teachers and keep them in the classroom. And we also know that 46% of our teachers over the next 10 years are going to be retiring. And those are the teachers that came in the 70s and so, and we know that we're going to be losing a lot of high-quality teachers, and so we need to replace them.
Mr. I apologize. We're down to about 7 or 8 minutes.
Okay, I'm about halfway through.
Thank you.
Then we also, as you know, I won't spend a lot of time on our QCOM proposal, but it is growing all the time. We have 44 school districts that are participating, 25 charter schools. I was just at a charter school this morning awarding their QCOM. I will be going to Annandale this afternoon, driving out there. To issue there and celebrate with them their QCOM application approval. We have 10 more school districts in the pipeline for QCOM, and so it is growing. It represents about 255,000 students now, and we are starting to see some really nice, promising results for academic achievement linked to QCOM. We also created, with your help, the Math and Science Academies, and we have, you can see the locations where they are, and I want to correct, it's not 1,100 teachers, but over 1,200 teachers have participated in the math academies, and in the summer our science academies will roll out, because that's when our new science standards will be taking, probably pass through rulemaking, and will be ready to be reviewed and taught by our teachers, so we'll be ramping that up. We have a great partnership with the Science Museum in relationship to that. We also have the Minnesota Principals Academy, because it isn't enough to support our teachers. We also need to support our principals. And right now, after the third year, we have 72 principals that have gone through. We have another 48 that are trainers. So if you add that together, it's a little bit beyond 100 principals now that have been trained. We hope, our goal is that all principals who want to be trained, who have had experience in the classroom or in their site, will have the opportunity to have this very comprehensive Principal Institute experience. We work in conjunction with the University of Minnesota to do this program. Also, we are looking at how we can measure our students over time, and as you all talked about, we have created the input of the legislature. We started that last year. The growth model is up on the website now, so you can actually go in. You just click on report card, and you can go to your own school, and you can see the information about how your students are doing in both proficiency and not proficient, but how they are growing along that trajectory to proficiency. It's very exciting. Our school districts are really excited about it, and I was at a charter school the other day who is looking at the data and drilling down into it, and they're really using it already to identify the kids that are doing well and what did they do, the best practices, et cetera. And we are excited about that as a department because we'd like to look at the BCS schools and districts and see how we can replicate and share that information with people. Also, we are doing a lot of achievement gap work with our school districts. We're focused on our districts that have not, or our sites who have not made AYT, and we're delivering that support in through our regional service cooperative. We have people that are trained, and we go out in conjunction with them, and we help with intervention strategies, analysis of their curriculum, their teaching, what they need to do to perhaps improve as they're looking at their data. And we also look at the data. That's a big part of what we do, is we go out and help and analyze the schools that need help. We also are looking at, we've had a process of looking at our data systems, and we're trying to improve those all the time. We've had a grant that has allowed us to do a lot of consolidation of some of our old legacy collection systems so that they'll be more state-of-the-art for school districts to use. And then really some of the good news, if you remember about a month ago now, last year, in 2007, our students participated in TIMSS. That's an international test that a lot of countries participated in. Minnesota and Massachusetts became their own little country and took the TIMSS test. And what was exciting was, and this is underlined, our fourth graders in 2007 recorded the third largest gain in math in the history of the TIMSS assessment when compared to fourth graders in 1995. It was a huge, huge triumph, really, for our state. I kind of kidded and said we should have had a parade down Nicollet Avenue, because it really did demonstrate that when we have focus on what our expectations are for kids, and our teachers are able to know what those expectations are, our teachers step up to the plate. They are skilled to do that instruction, and when they know what they need to do, they deliver, and our kids deliver. And this is a group also that in 2003, that's when our standards changed. So in 2007, these children have had the benefit of the complete instruction of our new standards. So you can see when our teachers do that and they're focused on the expectations of each grade, they can deliver it and our kids can measure up. Our eighth grade students also did very well, not quite as well, but they are up there in the top five countries of the world also. But they didn't have the benefit of all the standards, and so you can see, and then now the struggle that we're having with our high school students is demonstrated in the fact that they have not had as much benefit of all the new standards, which is why we are talking about a transition period right now for our high schoolers, and we think it is appropriate to do that. So that is really exciting news. The Star Tribune, actually, there's a quote. The latest TIMSS scores are encouraging. They demonstrate that efforts to improve instruction are working and to help sustain the scores in later grades and to close the achievement gap, the state and educators must learn the lessons learned by TIMSS. And we're going to be doing future analysis of the TIMSS so that we can continue to improve. Moving forward, we're looking at the governor announced the Teaching Transformation Act, which would include improving teacher training in college so that what is being instructed in our teacher ed colleges is aligned to the expectations. If we aren't training our teachers coming through the pipeline about our expectations, then there's a disconnect, so we want to make sure that happens. We want to provide a supportive environment for our teachers that are in the classroom now, and we want to implement a 21st century compensation system that will really reward teachers for the good work that they do. We want timely, effective assessments showing progress of students toward college and career assessments, and that is the discussion that Denise alluded to that we're trying to grapple with, and that we really need to make some decisions quickly because we don't want to spend money twice on maybe a system that we're not happy with, but move forward to a new system. And so we're going to be asking you to help us with that and make some decisions fairly quickly. And then we want strategies to close the achievement gap, including really intensive intervention for those students in eighth grade, and also looking at dropout prevention and positive behavior intervention strategies at the school district level. Lots of things that we could go into. I know your time is short, and I thank you for your attention to my presentation.
Commissioner, we look forward to many good interactions with you in the coming weeks. I appreciate you're a pro. You got it in under the gun here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You being with us here today. Members, we will meet again on Thursday. We'll take up Representative Breinert's report on Gulf model. We'll also have the presentation of that model from the department. We'll have our discussion on standards and assessments and our accountability system. By the way, members, I haven't quite decided. I think I'm really close. I don't think we're going to meet on Tuesday. Many of you know that's inaugural day, and the day before is Dr. King Day. I'm not quite sure what our floor schedule is, but at this point I'm leaning very heavily toward not meeting on Tuesday. So just so you know, we'll get a word out to you right away. And let me just close by saying that you are a member of a very, I have to say, a very good and proactive committee, a very good and proactive House. We were out on the cutting edge on a number of these issues in the last couple of years. I fully expect each and every one of you to be on the cutting edge of good public policy, and that's what we're here to do, and I look forward to working with all of you. So until Thursday, members, we are adjourned.